I'd like to make a couple of announcements before tonight's reading. Next Wednesday, here at 8 o'clock, there will be a reading by African-American poet Cornelius Eady, who wrote a really jazzy book called Victims of the Latest Dance Craze and has a new book out called Gathering My Name. So that will be here next Wednesday. And tonight after the reading, we have books for sale, compliments of the ASUA bookstore. We have, I think, The Light Possessed by Alan Shoes and a new anthology of stories, The Sound of Writing, as well as the collection of stories, The Tennessee Walls. So those will be for sale after the reading. Alan Shoes is from Perth Amboy, New Jersey. After working, among other things, as a toll taker on the New Jersey Turnpike, a ghostwriter, a bilingual high school teacher in Mexico, and a professor of comparative literature, he came to the habit of writing in his late 30s and has since published, among other works, Candace and Other Stories, The Bohemians, a novel based on the life of American communist John Reed, the novel The Grandmother's Club, in 1989, Fall Out of Heaven, an autobiography of a journey across Russia, which was a stirringly beautiful work of narrative nonfiction and reflection. And in 1990, two books from Gibbs Smith, The Tennessee Waltz and Other Stories, and the novel The Light Possessed, a book inspired by the life of Georgia O'Keeffe. Shoes is on the faculty at George Mason University in Washington, D.C. This year, he's visiting at the University of Houston. You know his voice, most likely, from National Public Radio's All Things Considered, where he's been regularly reviewing books for many years. He's also opened up a new vehicle for the publication of new works on NPR as the producer and host of the Penn Syndicated Fiction short story magazine for radio called The Sound of Writing. We're very happy to have his voice here among us for the evening. Please welcome Alan Shoes.
Good evening. Hi. Not only the voice, but the body. I was saying to some of the writing students this afternoon, I was reminded of that remark of William Gaddis's that the novelist is the Hulk that follows the workaround. So you've got the Hulk here tonight. But I'll try to help you forget the Hulk, if the work is any good. This is a novel called The Light Possessed, as Allison suggested, inspired by the life of O'Keeffe and a number of other American women painters. And, it's not biographical in that in any narrow way, but I think of it as a kind of rhapsody on a theme of her life and the lives of a number of other 20th century women painters. The title, The Light Possessed, comes from a Whitman poem, which I shall now read. Sometimes I think I wrote this novel so that I could read Whitman to you. This is called A Prairie Sunset by old Walt. Shot gold, maroon, and violet, dazzling silver, emerald, fawn, the earth's whole amplitude of and nature's multiform power consigned for once to colors, the light, the general air possessed by them, colors till now unknown, no limit, confine, not the western sky alone, the high meridian, north, south, all pure luminous color, fighting the silent shadows to the last. Thank you very much. This is a novel with two beginnings. You all probably know The French Lieutenant's Woman, which has two endings. This has two beginnings. And a number of narrators. It's got many voices in it. I'll read a few of them this evening. The first opening chapter is told by a man named Robert Bolden, who is the geologist's brother of Ava Bolden, the painter protagonist of the novel. And he's an old man in a nursing home in Chicago, looking back on his life as a young student of painting named Amy Cross is gathering material and information about the life of Ava Bolden, whose affairs she has come west to manage. The first section is called River. This is Robert Bolden. The world didn't begin with my sister, although I sometimes thought that it could hardly go on without her. The earliest I know of the rest of our family, or so it was passed down to us in a tortuous way, comes in the story of a small farmer from Kent named Wander, who sold his plot in the old land and took his wife and two small children to the New World, there to buy cattle and raise them on one of the Georgia Sea Islands. But on the voyage over, his wife fell sick and died, and so when he arrived here, this widower needed someone to attend to his two babes. On the other side of the island from his farm lay a small village of dark-skinned people, a mixture of Africans and Cherokee, many of them, it was said. A beautiful blend, to hear the story told to you, so that the tall, dark-haired girl he hired to help him with the rearing of the children had skin the color of mahogany and eyes a miraculous blue that seemed to mirror the ocean that she so often looked upon. Melissa Tree was her name, and she was an artist of sorts, the first and only in our family before the present generation, who collected seashells and painted with inks on the smooth inner side of bark. None of these artifacts survive except in the story. But the story has it that Melissa and Wander grew as close as sea and sand, and that she produced a light-complected child of her own as a result, and then another, and that she and the children were rowing to the mainland one afternoon in late summer when the sky suddenly turned from milky blue to dark purple, and a waterspout whirled up from the horizon and flipped them over as easily as a child might turn a card. "Help! Help! Mama!" the older children screamed. "Follow me," their mother is supposed to have called to them as she scooped up the youngest in her arms. "Walk." And they found solid stuff beneath their feet and walked to the shore, their mother waiting for them to catch up with her and then prodding them from behind on this hidden sandbar. Such was the feat that my own mother described to me as Mother Melissa's miracle on a warm Sunday afternoon on the edge of the sand hills when we were supposed to leave for church. And she took my hand and said that we were going for a walk instead. I was 4 years old, an obedient child, though I had been wondering lately about the size of my mother's belly. It had grown and grown, and my railroad man father, chief engineer for the region, had told me only that I was going to have a wonderful surprise one day soon to be delivered by angels. Father had a flat voice that sometimes sounded as though he were chewing pebbles. Mother's voice flowed slowly and thickly like caramel or honey. Father was upstairs still dressing. Mother led me out the door, and I didn't protest. But after a few hundred yards of walking over the prairie behind our house, I complained because this wasn't the way to church. And that was when she caught me up in the story to keep me going on our trek. We passed the tall cottonwoods that marked the border of our property. Who knew what lay beyond, except that because of the train whistles, I understood that the roadbed for my father's rail company lay in that direction. "You're a good boy, Robert," my mother said, squeezing my hand as we walked. "Can we stop?" I said. "Save you strength, because we have a ways to go. Where are we going, Mama? Not to church? Will we have a picnic? Do you want to go to church?" I shook my head, and she laughed. "You listen to me, and you won't ever have to go again, Robert." There was something in her voice, but I didn't question it, only followed along a dusty, narrow path lined with scrub trees. She was, after all, my mother, and I'd been trained to obey her. "My feet hurt," I said, as the path sloped down through the underbrush. "Take your shoes off if you like," she said, allowing me to stop and do so. "Is Papa coming?" I said. "He'll catch up," she said. "Where's the food?" I removed my shoes and now carried them one in each hand. "What food?" "For the picnic," I said. "That will come later," she said, taking my shoes from me and tossing them over her shoulder into the brush. "My shoes," I said. "You don't need those anymore," she said, herding me along ahead of her. "We're almost there." "Where?" I said. "Here," she said, pointing toward the river, which at this time of year still flowed with some force. "I want you to know something, Robert. When I was a girl," and she proceeded as she led me to the river's edge to finish the story of the miracle of Melissa Tree. "You can't do that," I said, meaning that she could not walk on water. "But I can try," she said. "I'm going to show you." "The water's cold," I said. "No, it's not," she said. "Give me your hand." I looked at her, but kept my hands at my sides. "My clothes," I said. You're such a good boy, Robert. Well, you don't have to come if you don't want to, but I'm going to do it, she said, and before my amazed stare, pulled her loose dress over her head. I couldn't take my eyes off her stomach, something I'd never seen before without it draped by clothes. Goosebumps played up and over her belly and her arms. Mama, I said, and began to cry. We can do it, little Robert, she said. It's in our blood. Here, once again, she offered me her hand. I shook my head. Very well, she said. I'll go alone. Or not alone. She patted her distended stomach. I was staring at it, its bulk, the odd, wild tuft of hair that grew out from between her legs, when she laughed, and I looked up and saw a hawk circling nearly directly above us. Are you sure, Robert? I have to hurry now. Tears burst from my eyes, and I stood, fists clenched, as she came toward me. I backed away up the path. No, Mama. No, what? You don't know. You don't know. Let me take you back with me to Georgia. Come now. An animal called out along the river. At least that was what I thought it was at first. All right, I said, feeling lost and awful and lonely and wanting her to love me. I couldn't look at her much longer without thinking that I would burst or float away, some terrible thing. Come now, she said, reaching up to take my hand. You don't have to undress. There's no time. She led me to the water. The current was strong, but I paid more attention to her pendulous breasts, to the light on her belly, the way her skin seemed to glow under the sun, and that hair, the animal hair, was how I saw it. That was how close we came before my father burst upon us from the trail, knocking me aside as he leaped toward my mother, capturing her roughly in his arms. No, she said in a wail. I want to go. I want to go, and you can't stop me. I rushed at him and beat at his thighs with my fist. Let her go. Let her go. He removed a hand from her in order to bat me away, sending me tumbling into the dust. Mama, Mama, I was crying over and over again as I watched him attempt to dress her, even as she kept on struggling. Louise, he said, Louise, you stop this. Hold still, hold still. She made a horrible noise, like something you might hear at night from a distance while trying to fall asleep, and she slipped from his grasp, leaving him holding her dress while she stood panting and moaning, her arms hanging limply at her sides, her eyes... Oh, her eyes were wild. I won't, she said, raising her fist above her belly. I won't. A few hard thuds sounded in my ears before my father took her in his arms again, this time wrestling her to the ground. Robert, he called to me. He was short of breath and sounded hoarse, like an animal himself. Go back to the house. That was when I discovered my own shortness of breath. Go, he said. Let me go, she said. Get, he said. I can't. Go. My shoes, I said. Go, he said. No, she said. I want to take him with me. My father raised his hand. A flat, ugly thud echoed across the clearing. I looked around to see blood seeping from the corner of my mother's mouth. We returned to the house, though I don't remember the walk. Father took me in his arms and put me to bed. And I know that I heard the doctor's voice drifting up the stairwell, a sour, dry speech that was punctuated now and then with small bird-like chirpings from my mother. My mother's shout awakened me early the next morning. The house filled with her moans, the sharp, barked orders of the doctor, the odor of salve and steam. A girl, the doctor came out of the room to announce around 6 that evening. Then there was a second girl, born a few minutes later, born dead. My mother died around midnight, and our lives, Ava's and mine, together, had begun. That's the opening chapter. Then here's the second opening chapter, which I hope lends a little relief. This is Amy Cross, Bennington student, daughter of Virginia, who takes up with a young fellow named Michael Gillen, who is you don't know this as you come into this chapter, but I'll just tell you. Gillen is the child born out of wedlock to the aging photographer whom Ava Bolden grows up to marry. But that all emerges slowly in this chapter. Hope some other things emerge quickly. Here's Amy Cross. Some of us took longer than others to get here and to find our vocations as well. Myself, I was only a few years past 20 when I started in this westerly direction in Michael's little maroon pickup with new tires that we bought with money that Sissy, his mother, gave us as a farewell present. though I suppose I'd taken my first step much further back than that, perhaps on a day in Virginia when I was walking and dreaming, as little girls do, along the banks of the Rappahannock, where my parents had always kept a summer house. And something about the way the sun caught on the rushing current drew me to a halt, and I stared for a long while at the dancing patterns of light. I came out the next morning armed with one of my father's yellow drafting pads and a grease pencil, trying to sketch the flow. How unmercifully my brothers teased me when they discovered what I was doing. I kept on drawing all through grade school and the upper levels too, and I took a giant step toward where I now live and work today when I applied to Bennington as an art major and was accepted. There I learned, among other seemingly useless things, that though I was only 5'5" and rather slender, I could drink with dirty old men and weld pieces of steel into sculpture. I remember the look my father gave me when he came up for the student show where my first creation appeared. "Is it going to be architecture then, Aime?" He had a pitiful look of hope in his eye. None of my brothers gave a damn for what he did. "Gee, I don't know, Daddy," I said, frightening myself with a sudden understanding of how much I wanted to please him. "Could be." I pushed some of my hair from my eyes and struck a pose that I'd seen other girls put on while talking about their work. "And then again, who knows?" "Well, I like this," he said, going up to the piece and giving it a good rap with his knuckles. "Daddy!" I cried out in alarm at his brazen act of philistinism. "Steel," he said, and I think he would have said it whether I was standing there or not. We're both lovers of steel and structure. This wasn't exactly true. I liked to work with steel. It gave me confidence to put a torch to those big sheets of metal, splashing sparks about with the alacrity of a welder on a bridge high above the New York docks. But I didn't love steel. I couldn't love anything until Michael came along and we began moving west. Excuse me. On those tires supplied by Sissy, his mother. "So off you go," she said with a wave of her red-knuckled hand as we went out the door of her little brick house on Washington Avenue in Albany. We'd swung by on our way out of Vermont to show her the tires and to thank her once again. "We'll bring you back some red dust or whatever it is they have out there, Mom," Michael said. "She's never been west of Buffalo," he turned to me and explained. "Rochester," she said by way of correction, "though I used to hear a lot of stories about that place out there, and it's all red dust and skies the color of turquoise stone and air so clear you can't even see it. That's what I've heard." "You've heard so much about it," Michael said. "Maybe you ought to come with us, Mom." "Oh, me," she said. "No, no, it's not for me. I'm just a girl from Washington County who fell into some interesting luck." She leaned toward her son, who stood next to me on the little stoop, and kissed him on the cheek. "You, Michael, you go, and take your Amy, who will be the new Mrs. Gillen. I blushed and reached for her hand, feeling much more horrible about lying to her than I did to my own parents about our situation. But Michael didn't want us to get married just yet, he said, and I didn't want to push him too hard, though I had a little surprise for him. "I'm going to keep my own name," I said. "It's been mine for so long." "Don't apologize for it," Sissy said. "We're not so particular with names in this household, are we, Michael? After all, the boy's got my name, not his father's." "Okay, Mom, that's goodbye then for now," Michael said, and tugged me from his mother and led me to the curb. "Bye," I called after her. "Goodbye, my darling," she said. "You shouldn't have been so short with her just then," I said. Michael gave me a look I'd never seen before and started up the engine with a vengeance. He threw the truck into reverse, and we lurched backward, nearly banging into the car behind us. "I know that you don't want to get married, but at least be careful," I said. "You're driving for three of us now." His mother was waving furiously from the curb as we drove off, rubber burning in the already thick Albany air. "Three," he said, holding the wheel as though it were a weapon. It was then that I explained what I'd been planning to tell him after we'd been on the road a while, finding perhaps some lovely romantic place for it, wherever that place out there might be. "You're joking," he said. "You're trying to fool around with my brain." "No, Michael," I said in a voice that sounded to me quite strange, as though it belonged to someone I'd just met. "I'm going to bear you a little cross." That's her joke, not mine. The road, Stanley Hyman shouted to us in Langan Lit class one morning. "All life is a road," and then he smacked his hands together and began shouting out that Ray Charles tune. "Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more." The myth man, my Michael called Stanley, and practically sat at his feet, like a disciple, sometimes even showing up in class and demonstrating by his comments that he'd read everything on the list with more care than most of the students on the roster. If it was unusual for a working-class boy from New York State to drop in on classes at Bennington and engage us girls in long discussions about Lord Raglan's The Hero, Stanley's favorite book, and Freud and Fraser and Marx, if it was unusual, we didn't know it, even when he prefaced the things he said with, "Well, hey, I'm the bastard son of a Manhattan photographer and a housemaid from Casa Yuna, New York, but the way I see it," and if this was unusual, we didn't know it. This was Bennington, and anything could happen. As you already may have figured out, some of it happened to me. Michael, I mean. He was painting a lot, but also working outside on some small metal pieces. One night I saw him as I came out of the painting studio. He was wearing goggles, the sparks were flying, and I thought to myself, this is some man. This is some man. So I guess I have to admit that I'm a coward, or maybe just a realist, because I never told him about me and Stanley. Not that it was more than a tiny little fling. Michael would have died, or worse, he would have brought it up to me a lot. I remember hearing my mother's whining voice all through my childhood about a thing my father had gotten involved in, and it might have been one night or 10 years, it didn't matter, because my mother never let it drop. Stanley stumbling in drunk to my room, trying to take off his pants. I worshipped him. He was so smart and sweet and tough all at once. I helped him off with his trousers and let him do it. I knew about half a dozen other girls who'd had the same experience, and it was exactly the way they described it when they talked about it. A little incestuous, a little bit like a visit from the family doctor. "Jesus and Moses," he shouted when he came. "Oh my God, Jesus and Moses." So when, as we were driving through Illinois on our way to New Mexico to see Michael's Aunt Ava, who had moved out there to paint before Michael was born, and he suddenly broke out into a war whoop, honked the horn, and shouted, "Hey, I got it! If it's a boy, we'll name him Stanley!" I nearly went into convulsions. Though I managed to recover quickly enough to say, "I didn't think we ought to saddle any kid with the burden of a funny name like that." "He's not funny to me," Michael said. "He's a great man, him and Paul Feeley. They're my fathers, you know. They really are, the fathers I never knew." We were zooming through cornfields near the Iowa border, and I couldn't really pretend that something fabulous lay outside the truck windows, fabulous enough anyway for me to turn around and stare at it. But I wanted to hide the deep blush that I could feel as heat on my cheeks at the thought of having made love to Michael's adoptive father. I stopped blushing after a while, but the cornfields ran on, and then the grain fields of Nebraska receding to the horizon, broken by little farm towns and bordered by straight roads and railroad lines, along one of which Michael's Aunt Ava, as he called her, had grown up. However, we didn't know that then. We didn't know much more about her than the few things his mother, Sissy, had told us. We even had the idea that Ava and Albert Stigmar, that's her elderly photographer husband, had divorced when Michael was conceived. Not that it mattered much, not to him. He loved that, being the bastard son. Not many men would, but Michael was special, a thing which had both its good side and its bad. And I had the worrisome feeling, only women know what it's like, that the baby might bring out as much of the negative side of him as the positive. First of all, no matter what we'd told his mother or my parents about our intentions, we still weren't married, which had been all right for me before I got pregnant, but riding along the interstate with the weight of the new child in my belly, or imagining the little Reed that he was at that stage as a weight, I wondered if we ought to break this chain of birth out of wedlock that Michael sometimes reveled in and stop in one of these small towns and find a justice of the peace and get married. "Beautiful," Michael said, and I was pleased with his reaction to my idea. But then he suggested we wait until we got to New Mexico because we'd have to take blood tests and all that, he reminded me. I was more than satisfied. But around the time we turned south and crossed the border of Colorado, he was already of another mind. "Amy," he said, taking my hand and squeezing hard, "I know this is going to sound crazy. It's just, you know, we don't have to rush into this marriage thing just because we're having a baby. I mean, I spent all my life so far being a bastard, and it hasn't been all that bad. Hey, and you know how Stanley pointed this out to me, how in Shakespeare the bad guys, the bastards, get all of the good poetry? The gods stand up for bastards." "Oh, Michael," I said, feeling a sigh rise within me, "you're such a stitch." I leaned over and lay my head on his right knee, feeling the power of his leg as he worked the gas pedal. In a moment, he pulled over onto the shoulder of the highway, and in the next, we scrambled out of the cab and into the truck bed and into his bedroll that still reeked with the oils and resins of the studio back in Vermont. You could hear the cars roar past on the highway. Nice girl from Northern Virginia, college educated, pregnant now, making love in the back of a truck parked off the interstate in northeastern Colorado, and then again as she crossed the border into New Mexico. Michael lay back just after having finished with me that second time and said, "Christ, do you realize?" "Realize what?" "My God," he said, and then closed his eyes and made an odd sound with his tongue. "Michael, what is it?" "We're nearly there," he said. "I know." I reached over and touched a hand to his cheek. "Maybe we should go back." "Why?" "I don't understand." "Well, what if she's just some crazy old lady?" He took a deep breath, and I could almost hear his lungs filling up as much with fear as with air. What if she doesn't want to see us? What if my mother's making this all up? "Michael, what if she's mean as hell? What about that? And we've spent all this money coming out here just to get turned around." "It's not for nothing," I said, sliding up alongside him so that my lips were even with his ear. "We've had some fun, and it's beautiful out here. Maybe we'll even stay." That sat him up, looking kind of sweet and silly as he looked out over the rocky landscape. "I can't stay out here," he said. "I've got my work. I can't stay anywhere. I'm going to be a father." "Oh, Michael, don't worry," I said in my first official act as a mother while cradling him in my arms. His mood lightened, though, the closer we got to Santa Fe. "Who's wouldn't, given the land around us? The sky," he kept saying in a voice filled with real wonder. "Look at that sky, and there, look, the mountains, the colors, all the way to Santa Fe and beyond." And that beyond, I have to admit, it got to me as well, despite the fact that the baby growing inside me was just about everything at that time. Having grown up in the demure and manicured landscape of Virginia and gotten something resembling an education in the tempered mountains of Vermont, my notion of height and distance left much to be desired, though I might have lived something like a full life without ever having known this. Space out here resembled the ragged edge of a painting, with all the lines and colors bleeding off into some infinity, the presence of which we in the East could easily hide from, but which nevertheless was always present, always lurking about the wings. When we stopped in a village a few miles off the main highway, Michael ate a Mexican lunch he repeatedly declared was the hottest meal he'd ever had. I couldn't do that to my baby, so I nibbled on bland tortillas and drank a little milk. The view from the patio was a feast in itself. The mesas leading away from the eastern horizon seemed like some kind of topiary made of stone. But the best view for me, of which we saw more and more as we got closer to our destination, was the ancient seabed that lay to the west toward the mountains. Here and there we could see dust devils spinning up out of the dry desert floor. Now and then we passed a car, a truck driven by a brown-faced man with long dark hair. Many signs were in Spanish. My breathing slightly altered by the climb toward the sky. A sign here for a reservation, a turn there, and we were passing through a crossroads, a gas station, a small weathered Adobe General store, and on toward the mountains again, climbing slightly. Suddenly, the sign bearing the name we'd seen on the map, the road dipped into a little bend at a dry riverbed. There was a turn to the southwest, and within minutes we were rolling up a small ravine toward the old ranch house and outbuildings. Out of the cab, stretched toward the sky, blink at the odd sun, a strangely white, nearly translucent brightness. A gasp at the altitude. Michael kisses me on my dry, cracked lips. Our limbs creak from sitting for so many days. We walk up to the house, up onto the stoop, knock at the striated black wooden door, knock again, no answer. We walk around to the side of the house, peer in through a large window that takes southern light, see its counterpart across the room to the north, a desk, books, rocks, on the wall a large steer's skull, dried flowers within it. We walk along the adobe corral wall behind the house, all still except for the sound of our feet in the dust and my breathing. Another black door, this one slightly ajar. We enter the corral, large wooden barn to the rear, the door open at the north end. Odd odors on the air, a slight resin tang, dusty native light, no sound, smell of oily wind, wind shifts, no sweet streak of scent. A dog barks in the distance, or coyote. Now the barn, where inside a shadow hovers like a large pool of dark water, the very air turned liquid. A table covered with tubes of paint, small orange rocks, bones, feathers, dried flowers, a bird's nest. "Look at this," Michael says, holding up a large dried fish. Then we turn at a sound outside the barn, look to the adobe wall across from the open doorway and blink, and see a slight weathered figure in jeans and tattered white shirt, an old man, no, a slight old woman, stick in hand, no, a long thin brush, standing perfectly still as a lizard might, as though she herself might have been painted on the wall, listening intently, not to the dog or coyote, not to the noise of the wind like the soles of feet brushing across the soft stone, not to my cry of surprise, not to Michael's whispered breathing, but I could almost swear it, as if she were listening to the sound of the tiny gurglings of my child within. Thank you. Just read one more very brief section. Four choruses, as I call them. Four voices of some women who appear in the book. The first is spoken by Eve, the ghost of the stillborn twin sister of Eva, who haunts her throughout the book. And then Louise Bolden, Ava's and Robert's mother. And I'll explain the rest. Eve, tell me about color. Tell me all the colors you've seen within your eye and without. Tell me about blue, blue without cease. And red, tell me of the nature of red, its fiery menstrual challenge, its lingering embers. Tell me about the ocean depths of green. Tell me green and pearl, off-white pearl, cream of petal, green-blue stem, and gray stone, gray, gray stone, ochre rock, tortilla earth, desert orange, slap of yellow wildflower in the eye, the come-hither look of violet, lush of purple, vermilion's odd assertion. Tell me the turquoise passage of winds shaping the pliable cloth of clouds. Louise Bolden. Tell me about the white of absence, the black of presence, these shades. Tell me how water bleeds the colors across the space of vision, how tense the oil. Tell me of the sheen of cobalt blue at rest and the flash of first crimson. The garden of insight watered by the fluids of exterior shapes. Melissa Tree. And line, too, speak of lines, the way a stretch of black moves across your eye and takes on the curvature of the earth. Tell me of rock and rising hillside, mesa of mesquite and distance, earth, dirt, the texture of stone underfoot, of air in the lungs, the weight of my breasts and arms upon the water. Tell me of the buoyancy of my body in this plane of mine in the flash flood that comes unawares upon me. Tell me, show me how oceans spill from the motion of your wrists, and I will learn how to perfect this story, how to write it in ink made of seashells and painted on the bark of trees. Eve. I see by the light that you show me, I see what it is like to walk upon the water and continue on across the plain of years over the mountains. Sister, mother, daughter, oh, you give me hope, you give me promise that I might try and try, and if I fail, and if I fall back into the territory of darkness, at least I'll have had a glimpse of what lies beyond. Show me then if color has a sound, and how line creates music, and if the shape of things takes on a shade visible near darkness, O Eva, and if light is the old metaphor for infinity, and if color is light given in the terms of the world. Succor me with this knowledge that when I awake from my dream, I may know something other than before I slept. Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you. I think we invite you to have punch. If it's like George Mason punch, it's probably not champagne. But come and have punch, and we'll talk out in the lobby if you like.